March Madness is officially underway, and all three Iowa universities are still in the game. How will they fare? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ben Kiefer. Iowa State beat Iona Gales yesterday in Denver. The Hawkeyes face Temple University in Brooklyn this afternoon. And Northern Iowa faces off with the Texas Longhorns. We'll talk with Rick Brown, veteran sports journalist, about how Iowa basketball is on the rise. Plus, changes in Iowa's open meetings law, a push to get more women at the state capitol, and a bill that may change the prosecution of peeping Toms in Iowa. Buckle up for your Friday news buzz. That's all coming up after this news from NPR. It's a news buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ben Kiefer. On Fridays, we like to have a series of short interviews covering some of the biggest news of the week. And this week, that undoubtedly means basketball. The NCAA tournament started, and for the second year in a row, all three Iowa universities made it into the March Madness tournament. Joining me now to talk about this year's March Madness is veteran sports journalist Rick Brown. Rick, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Claire.
So Iowa State faced the Iona Gales yesterday. They won 94-81. Where do they head now?
They remain in Denver, and they will play Arkansas Little Rock on Saturday. Arkansas Little Rock upset Purdue in double overtime. So things are looking pretty good for the Cyclones to move on to the Sweet 16.
So that victory over the Gales, some were expecting an upset. That might have busted a couple brackets.
Well, I'm sure it did bust a few brackets. I've seen some that had Iona beating Iowa State, and Cyclones brought their A game after getting bounced in the first round last year by Alabama Birmingham. Clearly a focused team, and really wasn't challenged that much by Iona.
Well, Monte Morris had a bit of an injury, but he was playing this game, right?
Yes, he played. He's got a shoulder injury. He's not at 100%, but he can still run that team. He may not be able to do some of the things he could do, but he's still a very capable point guard and a winning point guard.
So the Hawkeyes are up against the Temple Owls. How do you feel about their chances?
I think that's going to be a very close and competitive game, but I think the Hawkeyes will advance out of that game just because Iowa has more offense than Temple. So Iowa's season has really been up and down. They've been very unpredictable, but if I had to predict, I'd say they would win.
Because some are guessing that they were going to face early elimination.
Well, that's very possible. And if Iowa would win this game, they would play likely the number two seed Villanova on Sunday in the second round game. So the challenge is pretty steep for the Hawkeyes as we move forward.
Mm. What about UNI? How are they doing?
Well, UNI plays Texas, is a underdog against Texas, but recent history tells us that don't bet against the Panthers. They made the Sweet 16 in 2010 after knocking off Kentucky. They won the first round game last season as well, beating Wyoming. So Panthers have a real shot of staying alive.
Mm. So you're spending the entire week at the Wells Fargo Arena in Des Moines. None of our Iowan teams are there, but tell us a little bit about the atmosphere.
Well, the atmosphere is terrific. I never thought I would live to see the day when City of Des Moines hosted an NCAA regional. It's terrific for the economic punch it delivers, but more importantly for basketball connoisseurs, this gives them a chance to see three of college basketball's blue blood, so to speak, in Kentucky, Kansas, and Indiana at one site and one arena. So it's been great for Des Moines, and the city has really responded. Great crowds in yesterday's opening round.
You know, you make a good point there. Not only is Des Moines hosting a round of the NCAA basketball tournament for the first time ever, but for the second year in a row, all three Iowa teams are doing pretty well. Are we becoming a major force on the scene?
Well, I think we're lucky in that well, part of the credit goes to Fred Hoiberg, who's left Iowa State for the Chicago Bulls, but Steve Prohm, his successor, I think the program's in capable hands there. Fran McCaffrey's rebuilt Iowa's program, and Ben Jacobson has just been a rock in Northern Iowa. To have three coaches of that stature in our state at the same time is one of the reasons why these teams are having great success. But when you consider that Iowa has more teams in the tournament than the Southeastern Conference, one of the country's strong conferences, tells you a little bit about basketball in Iowa. We can play this game a little bit.
You mentioned some of those rock-solid coaches. Are there any athletes that you're really excited for this year?
Well, you have to start with George Niang and Jared Uthoff and Wes Washington. Give you a player at each school. George Niang is one of Iowa State's all-time scoring leaders. He started for 4 years. Jared Uthoff started at Wisconsin, transferred to Iowa after 1 year. He has had an All-American season. He and Niang were both All-Americans on some teams. Then Wes Washburn started Tennessee, transferred into Northern Iowa. He's a Cedar Rapids product. He's a dynamic player and really lifts that team. So they all have a player that got national attention this season.
Wow. Any other predictions as the tournament plays out?
Boy, you know, the beauty of this tournament is that there is no overwhelming favorite. So just be prepared if you do a pull sheet to use a red line and cross out quite a few picks, because it's going to be totally unpredictable from here to the finish line.
Wow. Well, Rick Brown, veteran sports journalist, thank you again for coming on the program.
You bet, Claire. Thank you.
Less than a quarter of the Iowa legislature is women, with only 7 women serving in the Senate. One group is trying to change that. 50-50 in 2020 is a nonpartisan nonprofit whose aim is, intuitively, to realize gender equality in state politics by the year 2020. They're hosting a 2-day program at the state capitol at the beginning of April called See Yourself Here. Jean Lloyd-Jones is the founder of the organization, and she's with us now. Jean, thank you so much for joining the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So before we talk about the event, help us understand the state of gender equality in Iowa politics right now.
Well, women make up 23% of the Iowa legislature, and we started this organization in 2010, thinking that it would take us a decade to reach gender equality. We are not going to reach gender equality by 2020, which will be the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage, and that is largely because women are very reluctant to get involved in running. We've done a lot of study and research on why that is. But one of the reasons that not very many women will say, but in addition to the fact that they don't feel that they're qualified, or they have family considerations, or they don't want to get involved in the media, or whatever. They have lots of reasons. But we found there was one that they weren't saying out loud, and that is they really don't know what a legislator does. And they find the whole idea of going to the state capitol just a little bit intimidating. And that's why we decided to start this program called See Yourself Here, because it all starts in the mind. You know, you have to see yourself in a position before you can even say, I want to do that.
So tell me a little bit about the seminar itself. What does it accomplish? What's on the agenda?
We give them a behind-the-scenes look at the Iowa legislature. They get to meet the nonpartisan staff, they get to meet the legislators, the legislative leaders in both the House and the Senate. They get to meet the women legislators, and that's what they like most of all. They watch a little bit of the opening of the session, but we don't spend a lot of time just letting them sit around. They actually meet with and interact with the movers and shakers and the other people at the legislature that they would meet, whom they would meet in the normal course of a legislative day.
So this is the third year of this seminar. Tell me a little bit about the discussions you've had in previous years. You know, what are the biggest takeaways from those years for you?
Almost to a person, they say, they come away saying, okay, so this is what it's like at the legislature. These are just ordinary people like us. Several people have said, I didn't realize that you had help to write bills and to come up with budgets for your for the programs that you wanted to initiate. There's just a whole lot that people don't know about the legislature and how it works. And so when they can actually meet the staff people who help write the bills, they feel very relieved. These are really nice people. And if you come to them with, you know, I have this idea, I thought maybe we could do this, these are the people that will put it into legal language and make it actually possible for you to file such a bill. Mm-hmm. So it's what we call demystifying the legislature for these women. Gives them a lot more confidence that, yes, I could do that.
You've spoken a lot to the process of getting women to run in the first place, but I'd love for you to touch on the challenges women face when they're actually running.
You know, the interesting thing is that women win in the same percentages that men do in comparable races, but seven times as many men actually run. So we, you know, women face the same challenges that men do. We hold in the even-numbered years an event called the Blueprint for Winning, and it's like a campaign school. It's a two-day-long, very intensive program where we teach them how to run a campaign, the things they have to do, forming a campaign committee, raising money, how to refine your stump speech, your campaign image, things like that. You know, some of them find this a bit tough, but say that it is very, very helpful to them when they actually get into the nitty-gritty of the campaign.
Mm. Iowa is one of 27 states that's never elected a female governor. You know, are we just saw the first woman speaker of the House this year. Are leadership roles particularly important when it comes to gender parity in politics?
They certainly are. When you want to change the culture of the institution, the rule of thumb is you have to have one-third of the body be female. And that doesn't just mean, you know, you have to have 33 1/3% of clerks be women. You have to have women legislators, elected leaders. And having a woman, we not only have a woman Speaker of the House now, but we have a woman President of the Senate. Pam Yocum has been President of the Senate for the last 4 or 6 years, I think. And those things are very important, to have women leaders. Someone speculated that one reason that more women seem to be stepping up this year to run is the very fact that we have a woman running for president of the United States. I mean, it's just being able to see a woman in that role is encouraging to some women.
You mentioned Hillary Clinton. We've had a lot more prominent women, it feels like, both at the state level and the national level. Do you think things are getting better for gender parity in politics?
I think things are getting better, but I don't want people to be lulled into thinking that we're making great progress, because we're not. We had the first woman in Iowa was elected to the Iowa legislature in 1929. Her name was Carolyn Pendray from Jackson County. And at this point, we have 34 women in the Iowa legislature, and we figured out that if we keep on at this pace, we will reach gender equity by the year 2097.
Wow.
So that's one reason that Maggie Tinsman and I were the co-chairs of 50-50 in 2020, one Democrat, one Republican, said, let's just see if we can't get a larger number of women to actually take that step and run for office.
Before you go, tell us, where can people go to get more information on the See Yourself Here seminar?
Yes, they can register online. It's www.50in2020.org. There it will come up, and this event is right on the home page, so they can register right there. And we hope to see a lot of women taking advantage of this opportunity.
Jean Lloyd-Jones is the founder of 50-50 in 2020. They're hosting a See Yourself Here seminar April 5th and 6th at the state capitol. Jean Lloyd-Jones, thank you so much for joining the program.
Thank you so much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. On Fridays, we like to look back and cover some of the biggest stories of the week. In 2013, a landlord in Iowa City was charged with spying on tenants through peepholes in his apartment complex. He spent a couple weeks in jail, paid fines, but Ruth LaPointe, one of his victims, says the punishment didn't go far enough. She's lobbying at the State House to make it easier to prosecute Peeping Toms, and she joins us now. Hello, Ruth. Thanks for joining the program.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start with your story. How did you end up becoming an advocate for this bill?
Yeah, well, I was a clerk last session in the Iowa House, and I saw it just reading the news one day that a bill had been introduced in the Senate by Amy Sinclair, which addressed Peeping Toms, and it was in response to a Des Moines police officer who had been caught in the act looking at women in a locker room but wasn't charged with any crimes because it was under debate whether or not the women were nude. And that's when I learned that there was these provisions in our law that required a peeping Tom to be not only aroused, but for their victim to be nude in order to be charged. So, and that's when I started following the bill and really advocating for it.
Tell us a little bit about what happened to you with your landlord.
Yeah, well, when I was going to college in 2012, a couple years ago, I found out through fellow tenants that another person in my college apartment had caught our landlord looking at them through a peephole in their apartment. And after he had spoken to the police, he admitted to looking at many other tenants, including myself, was eventually charged with 11 counts of invasion of privacy. But a notable part of this whole experience was that during the trial to convict our landlord, me and the other women were having to describe whether or not we noticed our landlord was aroused prior to being convicted of the crime, and we found out that that was required for him to be convicted, which was very disturbing.
Wow. So what was the punishment for your landlord?
I believe he spent 140 days in jail and was charged with 11 counts of invasion of privacy, which did only address the women who lived in his apartments, even though there were men who may have had peepholes near their showers or bathrooms. Because of the arousal criteria, he didn't get charged with as many counts as he could have, and is now still currently a landlord in Iowa City.
Wow. You mentioned talking about arousal and how you had to speak about that in court. How did it feel to have the burden of proof rest on you?
Well, it felt very heavy, especially because that's a very hard thing to prove, but also because of the nature of this crime, we all felt humiliated and sexually and in other ways, and to have to mention that as a requirement was, again, was additionally degrading when he had already admitted to looking at us, building these peepholes, everything that we thought was relevant to a crime. So, it was very frustrating in that process.
Mm. So before we talk about what this proposed bill would do, help us understand what's currently legal and illegal under Iowa Peeping Tom laws.
Yeah, well, the most relevant criteria under the current law is that a peeping Tom is not guilty unless their victim is nude or partially nude, which again came up in the Des Moines police officer case, but also if the peeping Tom is not aroused by the act, it is also not a crime.
So what would this bill, Senate File 2185, do?
It would make it so that if you believe yourself to be in a private place and assume privacy, that someone who is viewing you without a legitimate purpose is guilty of a crime. And you don't need any other criteria for that.
So how would that have changed your case?
Well, in our case, it probably would have meant an additional charges of invasion of privacy for the men that he viewed and maybe supposedly wasn't aroused by viewing. But it also would have just meant that we wouldn't have to undergo that part of the trial where we're needing to recall degrading details, and we could have proceeded much quicker.
Wow. So where is this bill currently in the legislature?
It is currently eligible for debate in the Iowa House. It cleared the Public Safety Committee in the House a couple weeks ago and cleared the Senate unanimously prior to that. And I guess it's to my understanding that it's being amended or changed. There may be some controversial language that is holding it from being eligible or going to the House floor.
Do you know what type of controversial language that is?
It's unclear to me, and I guess it's still to my understanding that the language is helpful. It just maybe could be more helpful. I think it's well-intentioned changes. But I guess the way the legislature works is if things don't occur in a certain timely manner, the bills end up dying. So in my opinion, it should be passed as is, given that it passed the Senate unanimously, and I'm worried they won't concur with any changes.
It sounds like it has a fair amount of support. There was a similar bill like this in the legislature last year. Why didn't that bill pass?
I guess the best excuse I can give is political reasons. Again, it passed the House unanimously last session and died in committee in the Senate. And again, I really don't know the full reasons for that, but as far as I know, the bill got politicized and just died on arrival.
We just spoke with Jean Lloyd-Jones. She's the founder of 50/50 in 2020, about the effort to get more women at the State House. Tell us about your journey to becoming a clerk in the Iowa House.
Yeah, well, I've always been active in politics since I've been young, and being a clerk in the State House has really, I guess, fueled that fire a lot, because there's a lot of knowledge that you gain just by seeing people in action, and it's very inspirational to see legislators do their job and to see real change happen. So I guess this whole experience has definitely made me think that I could potentially someday make legislative change, not only hopefully passing this bill into law, but maybe something more someday. But I encourage other women to do the same.
Wonderful. Ruth LaPointe, clerk in the Iowa House and advocate for Senate File 2185, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up after the break, we'll speak with IPR State House correspondent Joyce Russell about the length of the legislative session, talk about President Obama's nominee for the United States Supreme Court, and discuss a decision that came down this morning from Iowa's Supreme Court. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. Stay with us. And we're back with the News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ben Kiefer. President Obama nominated D.C. Circuit Court Judge Merrick Garland to the Supreme Court on Wednesday. Joining me now to talk about Garland's background and how he may fit into the current bench is Ryan Copemans, attorney at Nyemaster Good in Des Moines. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So what do we know about Merrick Garland's background? What can his previous rulings tell us about how he may lean in certain cases?
Well, I think you start with his education and growing up. I mean, he's kind of the blue chip Supreme Court nominee, I guess you could say. He's a double Harvard guy. He graduated at the very top of his class in undergrad, was a valedictorian. Then he went on to clerk for two legendary judges, Henry Friendly on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, and then William Brennan on the Supreme Court. And for those who don't know Brennan, Brennan is to the left what Scalia was to the right. You know, he's kind of this liberal icon. So this is the background that he brings to court. He is then a prosecutor, a government attorney basically all his life. He prosecuted the Oklahoma City bomber, Timothy McVeigh, and then he goes on, of course, to become a Clinton appointee to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is like the scout team, if you will, for the Supreme Court. It's where a lot of the Supreme Court justices come from. And what they hear are pretty boring cases on a what we would think of as boring cases, a lot of government agency cases about whether this agency had the power to do this or that. And so that's the background that he comes from. So he is, to that general extent, a boring candidate. That I mean, he's very qualified, but a boring one. And maybe that's what the president was going for in this highly divisive time in the Senate.
You mentioned the Oklahoma City bombings case. Much is being made of that, maybe because the rest of his career is boring, in your words. What impact might that case have had on his career?
Well, he's known as a little bit more pro-prosecutor, pro-government than other Democrat appointees will be. And it's possible, for example, that he could be to the right of Justice Scalia, who is known as a little bit more of a libertarian justice when it comes to criminal matters, the Fourth Amendment. So that kind of prosecutor background, you know, he could shape him, certainly could make him align more with Justice Breyer, who is also more pro-government when it comes to criminal matters, when it comes to the power of the government, generally speaking.
You've touched on his so-called safe choice nature. How would an appointment of him affect the Supreme Court's liberal conservative leanings?
It would change it dramatically, I guess I should say. He has been thought of and considered as kind of a moderate pick, which he is. But on these kind of issues that divide the court, 5-4, split it right down the middle, you can pretty much assume that he will be on the side of what we would call the liberal justices. So even though he's a moderate pick on those big issues, he would switch the vote from the 5 being on the conservative side to the 5 being on the left side. You know, things, for example, you can pick one, gun control, for example. He was a dissenter to the D.C. Circuit opinion in D.C. versus Heller. This is the case that said that there is an individual right to bear arms, and that struck down D.C.'s gun control laws. He objected to the D.C. Circuit 3-judge opinion that came out of that. And so we can expect something, you know, if he were on the court at the time, of course, on the Supreme Court when Heller came out, it would have went 5-4 most likely the other way with the D.C. gun ban being upheld.
Are there any clues in his past, any views he might have that could give conservative Americans hope?
Well, it depends on what you consider, you know. The conservative judicial movement has kind of broken into two at times. And so for those who are still kind of law and order conservatives as opposed to kind of libertarian conservatives, he gives them hope in that he will be a more law and order justice than some of his more liberal colleagues.
The nation thought Iowa's Judge Jane Kelly might be the nominee. She was vetted by the White House. Any guesses on why she wasn't ultimately chosen?
No, none really. You know, she comes from a completely different background as Judge Garland. She, of course, was a federal public defender, so she was on the other side of the V in those criminal cases, had a kind of different perspective. You know, there are plenty of prosecutors on the Supreme Court, people with prosecutorial backgrounds. There are no public defenders. So from that case, she would have given a different flavor, but perhaps she would have been more controversial as well, which, again, president might be looking to avoid that given the Senate's position about no hearings at the moment, which, of course, politically speaking, if we can jump into that, too, I mean, with obviously everything with Trump and how the presidential election is turning out kind of throws all of that into a wrench and will make for some interesting court watching and Senate watching.
No kidding. If the Senate Republicans follow through on that promise and they don't appoint him to the Supreme Court, they don't hold the hearing, or they hold the hearing and vote him down, do you think there's a chance he might be nominated again if a Democrat takes the White House next year?
There's always a chance. I think it's more likely that if Secretary Clinton wins, for example, which would seem the more likely Democratic outcome, that she would probably look to appoint someone younger, perhaps, you know, Sri Srinivasan, who was known as a popular pick or thought to be likely Obama pick, might be someone she would nominate. He's in his 40s, and therefore his tenure on the court would last much longer than Judge Garland's. He's 63 years old. You also have calls for more kinds of diversity on the court, especially from those in the left. And so you know, perhaps someone from a minority group, someone who is not either Catholic or Jewish, someone who didn't perhaps go to Harvard. Right now, every justice on the Supreme Court attended Harvard or Yale at one point. Justice Ginsburg eventually graduated from Columbia but started off at Harvard and transferred. So you might look for Clinton or someone else to nominate someone with a different educational background. So while it's very possible that Judge Garland could be renominated in the new administration, I think we'll find the new Democrat nominee, if it is a Democrat, selecting someone further to the left.
Brian Copeman's attorney at Nye Master Good in Des Moines, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth, in for Ben Kiefer. On Fridays, we like to have a series of short interviews covering some of the biggest news of the week. And if last year is any indication, we are about halfway through Iowa's legislative session. Here to help us parse what's happening at the Capitol, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Claire.
So we're possibly in the latter half of the session now. What has surprised you most this year?
Surprised me most. Well, I'm a little surprised at how much of a let's get done and get out of here vibe there is, although it shouldn't have surprised me since it is an election year. But after that lengthy drawn-out session last year, there's definitely a vibe of there's no point in dragging it out. The two parties are going to have to hammer out their disagreements over education funding, but there's definitely a feeling that they're going to get it done.
Well, that's interesting. Last year, lawmakers couldn't agree on a budget until early June. So you think they're on track to end the session earlier this year?
Well, the 100th day of the session is April 19th. And the couple of pieces have fallen into place. The most recent this week was the final revenue estimates. The revenue estimating conference meets in December. And that's the number that people put their budgets together with. But then they meet again in March, and they made their estimates for tax revenues for this year and next. And those are the final numbers that the legislature has to work on. So you can't really get down to business on the budget until you have that final number of how much money you have to work with.
So what's the next step for the budget?
Well, we're going to start seeing, you know, the various budget subcommittees get down to business and do their work. They'll have their targets. The Republicans in the House are going to have the same targets that they put out a few months ago. The Democrats in the Senate and the governor are both going to have to revise their budgets down slightly because of these new revenue estimates. But now that that's done, we'll start seeing the various budget subcommittees hammering out their budgets.
Mm. You attended a hearing this week on bills that address the alleged abuse at Midwest Academy. What's the outlook for those?
Well, both the oversight committees in both the House and the Senate are putting bills together to address what happened down at Midwest Academy. This, as you know, is a privately run boarding school. And it's essentially a place where families can enroll their children who have just had difficulties elsewhere. But there's evidence of really significant abuse of children there. The place has been shut down. And the hearing this week that I attended was essentially the Department of Education and the Department of Human Services both explaining how this privately run boarding school for children just didn't fit into any category that either the DHS or the DOE would oversee. And so the proposed legislation would remedy that, create a new category of privately run residential boarding school, and then create oversight both from the Department of Education and the Department of Human Services.
You know, that news just broke about a month ago. Is the legislature typically that responsive?
Oh, yes, definitely. Almost every year there's something that breaks in the news that the legislature was not expecting to deal with. And this is a good example of that. But generally, yes, the legislature, if people are hearing about it in the news, reading about it in the paper, they want to be responsive. So there isn't anything unusual about them coming in and some proposing some legislation here.
We're through both funnels now. Are there any bills that didn't make it through the funnels this year you think might come up again in the future?
Well, there are some, you know, perennial bills that come up a lot. Fireworks, for example, might be one of those. But I think that one of the big issues or the big thing that Governor Branstad put out for the legislature this year was to take this special sales tax for schools and divert some of it to water quality. There are several bills out there that take that special sales tax for schools and divert it to other things, not necessarily water quality. But I think that's a good example of an issue that is not likely to get settled this year, but they have plenty of time. I think it's several years before that sales tax needs to be extended. And so that's almost certainly something that they just got started talking about this year.
Mm. Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent Joyce Russell, thank you again for joining the program.
Okay, thank you, Claire.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. In October of last year, the Iowa Supreme Court heard a case concerning what some might call a loophole in Iowa's open meetings law. After nearly a five-month wait, their decision came down this morning. Iowa Public Radio reporter Sarah Bowden joins us to discuss the case. Hello, Sarah.
Hey, Claire.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So tell me, how did the court rule?
So the court ruled that if you use someone as an agent and make a decision or communicate through this person who's acting on your behalf, then that does violate Iowa's open meetings law. In Iowa, a meeting is defined as when a governing body, so this could be a commission, a council, a board, when the majority of members meet to deliberate. So in the case of Warren County, anytime two of the three members have a meeting to deliberate, that means that it triggers the open meetings law.
So before we get to the Supreme Court case, tell me about the event that catalyzed it.
Yeah. So early 2014, the Warren County Board of Supervisors started considering a reorganization, which meant layoffs, which resulted in the layoffs of 12 county employees. And because they were aware of this rule that to trigger Iowa's open meetings law, anytime a majority of members of a governing body met, they kind of create the sort of workaround to try and skirt the state's open meetings law, which is not only includes in-person meetings, but also electronic meetings. So email, phone conversations, that sort of thing. So what they did is they had their county administrator kind of act as a go-between among the three board supervisors to flesh out ideas that they wouldn't have to discuss it publicly and maybe have to answer awkward questions or deal with public anger. So, for example, the county administrator drafted up these letters with recommended severance packages, and then the three supervisors looked at the letters, made suggestions, gave her the suggestions, which she then relayed to the other two supervisors. And long before the board actually publicly voted, like a couple weeks before the board publicly voted on to do these layoffs, county employees received these letters saying that their positions were probably going to be eliminated. And so then they actually voted, I think it was like early April. And this vote was like at a 20-minute meeting. There was no public comment, no questions. So really, this whole process took place outside the public eye.
Interesting. So the employees sued.
They sued.
What were their arguments?
Well, their arguments were that when you have a meeting of ideas, a meeting of concepts, even if the county board wasn't in the same room together, there was still a meeting. They lost that argument at the district court, and then it went all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Interesting. What was the Board of Supervisors' response to that?
Well, they're saying that they didn't have a meeting. They weren't in person. They weren't meeting electronically. So the whole idea of meeting of a collection of concepts they thought was bunk. It's important to note that Iowa's Open Meetings Code applies to both formal and informal meetings, and it says that any ambiguity should be resolved in favor of openness.
Yeah. So you mentioned this concept of an agent. The ruling depends on whether the Board of Supervisors so-called acted through an agent. Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah. So this is a concept that goes back to the early 20th century by Associate Supreme Court Justice, U.S. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who says, "He who acts through another acts as himself." And it's important to note that this was not a concept presented in the brief from the former employees. It was put forth by an amicus brief submitted by the Iowa Freedom of Information Council and the Iowa Newspaper Association, which Ryan Copemans, who you had on earlier, he was actually the attorney to pen this brief.
Interesting. Is that typical that a court issues an opinion
No.
using a theory set forth by that type of brief?
Definitely not. It's very rare. And in fact, in his dissent, I believe it was Justice Waterman said, like, this is, we don't do this. We don't take briefs or arguments generally from an amicus brief. This is not something we generally do. And he took exception to that. But hey, it worked. So, I mean, congrats, Ryan.
So the court reversed the lower ruling and, quote, remanded it with directions. What does that mean?
Well, it means that even though it was pretty transparent in the majority opinion that they felt like the Board of Supervisors had used the county administrator as an agent, that's not really for the Supreme Court to decide, though it could eventually work its way up to the Supreme Court again, but it first needs to start at the district court. So and there was no disagreement with what had happened between the two parties. So what I'm guessing is probably going to happen is that this is going to go back to the district court. The district court judge, who didn't seem happy about what had occurred but felt like she had to rule in a certain way, will now say probably, yes, you used your county administrator as an agent. And then probably things will go much more favorably for the former county employees who had sued.
Interesting. So you mentioned earlier Ryan Copemans working with the Iowa Freedom of Information Council. You know, this case was originally just between the Board of Supervisors and the employees they fired, but that Freedom of Information Council and the Iowa Newspaper Association got involved. What's their stake in this?
Well, open records, power of the press, the ability to watch your government in action. It's no secret that these sorts of organizations, journalistic advocacy organizations, really advocate for governmental transparency. And so while they're happy that this loophole has been closed, I talked with the head of the newspaper organization this morning, and she said, well, she's very, very happy that this happened. She still, about how the court ruled, she still says that there's a walking quorum or shuttle diplomacy problem because of that whole, it has to be a majority rule. So, for example, if you have a city council that has 7 members, 3 of those members or 2 of those members can meet and then go and talk to other members and work something out. So what happened here in Warren County could potentially happen and be legal with a larger elected body or a governing body.
Interesting. So end of the day, what does this mean for citizens' access to government communication?
Well, it means a good thing, especially because there are so many 3-member panels and boards and councils in Iowa. For example, the Iowa Utilities Board, that's a 3-member board or a 3-member So three-member border commission. So it means good things for Iowans who believe that they want to be able to see their government in action, have access to how officials make decisions. But this walking quorum, this shuttle diplomacy issue, I guess you could say, it's not like it's off the table.
Okay. Well, Sarah Bowden, Iowa Public Radio reporter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Claire.
And that's it for today. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production help today from Dennis Reese, John Pemble, and Jason Burns. If you want more River to River, you can find podcasting and on-demand audio at our website. That's iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. We always welcome your questions and comments by email at river2river@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Claire Roth. Thanks for joining us. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.